of our heart. I'd like to introduce you all in a moment to our guest speaker, but first I'd like to share a little bit about her background with you. Dr. Vivian Jokoto worked with a UNICEF program in her native country of Ghana prior to moving to the United States, where she spent 7 years working for Trillium Family Services, a residential facility for at-risk youth, prior to her current position at Western Oregon University, where she researches risks and protective factors for family and youth violence prevention and restorative justice in criminal justice. Her research in the United States has occurred through her involvement with Polk County Victim Offender Reconciliation Program. Some opening words before we hear from Dr. Jokoto. These come from a text titled Between the World and Me by writer Ta-Nehisi Coates. But all our phrasing, race relations, racial justice, racial chasm, racial profiling, white privilege, even white supremacy, serves to obscure that racism is a visceral experience, that it dislodges brains, blocks airways, rips muscles, extracts organs, cracks bones, breaks teeth. You must never look away from this. You must always remember that the sociology, the history, the economics, the graphs, the charts, the regressions, all land with great violence upon the body.
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak here today. I'm very privileged to be amongst you today and to enjoy in the fellowship of such grace. Thank you for welcoming me here. My name is Vivian. I prefer to go by Vivian. Yeah. Sometimes I think I just reserve Dr. Jokoto for my mom. I say I got it for her. So, all right. So I come from Ghana in West Africa, and so just so you, I'm sure you realize I speak with a different accent. I'm hoping that you can hear me, and feel free to laugh when I say anything funny. And because of my accent, if you can tell that it's something funny, I'll let you know, so you can laugh. Anyway, so I'm here to talk to you today. Well, thanks to Lana for the beautiful introduction. And I wish I could talk like she read to you, but unfortunately, I don't have that skill. Thank you. I'm here with my sister Hilda, too. She came just to accompany me here. And thanks to Reverend Craig Morrow for inviting me to come. All right. So just a little bit about my background, and I'll be brief. As a teacher, I'm not used to speaking within 20 minutes. And so I'll try to keep it brief, and I'll keep an eye on the clock over there. Anyway, so a little bit about my background and why I do what I do. I came here in 96 from Ghana, where I was born and raised. And when I got here, I had some experience with restorative justice. I had some experience with alternative forms of dealing with crime and punishment that I hadn't seen here when I got here. And I believe that life brings us experiences that then point us in the directions we need to go. So I quickly, about 3 years after being here, I got into a situation that got me thinking seriously about restorative justice. So this would be my experience with a car accident. So I was driving, and a driver drove through an intersection, didn't stop, and hit my vehicle on the side really bad, and basically totaling the vehicle. So I got out of the vehicle, checked to see whether the other driver was okay, and he said he was going to step in a house nearby and make a phone call. So he went into the house, and that was the last I saw of him. So he apparently ran through the house and then on his way. So an officer came by and took information about what had happened. And everything was fine. I was fine, went home. The officer promised me they were going to work hard to find the person who did this. So about a day later, the officer showed up at my house to tell me what was good news, that this person had been arrested, and it turned out he was driving on a suspended license. He was driving under the influence of drugs, and he had just come out of prison and was on parole. So he ran away because he didn't want to go back to prison, and so they found him. At that point, I still didn't know what was going to happen. I knew for sure that he didn't have insurance, and so I was going to have to pay for it myself, pay the difference to have my insurance cover it. So the officer came back a few days later and said to me that the person had been sent back to prison, and he was going to stay in prison for 10 years. So it wasn't 10 years for the hit and run, but it was 10 years because he had violated a probation for an offense that he previously committed. So he was gone for 10 years. So I was very conflicted by this, because to me, this started very quickly, and before I could get a grasp on anything that was happening, I felt like the case was over and before I could wake up from my dream. But this, I was left traumatized, and for a long time after that, I wasn't driving very well, because I kept thinking that every driver driving towards me wasn't going to stop. So I was being so careful that there were many times when I could have caused an accident. So I lived with this until I had to get over it. Well, so this got me thinking about restorative justice, because it didn't sit well with me that this is the solution that they came up with, whoever they is, right, came up with to deal with this issue. So I started going back to what I knew back in Ghana about how you make people whole after a crime occurs. And that wasn't present in this criminal justice system that I was now a part of. So I started to think about this, and that directed my research back towards restorative justice. So I then got an opportunity to be in court another time. This is with another case, where at this point I was helping, and I'm going to try to not be too detailed about this next story, because you could easily trace who is involved in this. So I'm going to be a bit vague. But this was a case, and my role in court at this time was as a professional. And so I was just part of the court process to allow access for this person who had been charged with a crime to gain access to the justice system. So I sat beside this person as the proceeding went along. And the case involved a husband and wife. So basically, the husband was being charged for spousal rape. And prior to us getting into the court for the hearings, a lot had happened between the prosecutor and the defense attorney regarding the case. And so parts of it had to do with bargaining, agreeing to plead to charges other than ones that were originally committed, or disagreeing to that and therefore going to trial. So there was all of that involved. And then when the trial proceeded, we went through this for, if I remember correctly, probably 2 days. And then it came to an end with a verdict. So the last day of the trial, we actually got to see the victim. And what had happened was there was a birthday party for the wife. And everybody had been drinking during the birthday party. So later on, there was some kind of commotion between the husband and wife. And what the wife had done was reach out for the phone and dial 911 and left the phone off the hook. So the 911 dispatcher was picking up on everything that was going on in the house and therefore trying to make sense of it from her end. So the that was the key evidence, which was the reason why this person was really, really on the hook for this and couldn't escape it. Now, the wife didn't realize that this was going to happen when the alcohol was all gone and all of them were back. They realized that there was a case that they had to deal with the police, right? And so the case went to court, and here we were in the courtroom dealing with it. So the verdict was read, and before it was read, the wife asked to make a statement to the court. So all of us were expecting her to show up and talk about how much this incident hurt her. But instead, she took to the stand and started to cry. So here I was as a professional in the court, not supposed to show any emotion. And I couldn't hold it together because she was really the victim in my eyes, in the sense that she had a little baby with her. The husband, who was going to go away for 15 years, was the breadwinner. So the husband was going to go away the woman was going to be left at home taking care of the child, and she didn't know how she was going to do that. She truly loved her husband and didn't think this arose to the level of this punishment. She wasn't intending to report this crime the way it had ended up being reported and handled. So that again brought me back to this issue about justice. So whose justice were we talking about here? Whose justice? So this was a question that weighed heavily on me because I saw this woman who had been victimized all over again. The answer that the judge gave to her at that time was, well, this has nothing to do with you. This has everything to do with the crime that your husband has committed against the state. So, whose justice is this? So just like in my story, which was, you know, nothing compared to this family that had just been ripped apart, whose justice? When we talk about justice, our current criminal justice system doesn't address victims. So, just as I felt invisible in this process, and if anybody had contacted me, the last thing I wanted would have been to see this person who hit me by accident go to prison for 10 years. But at least what I would have asked for would be for him to work and pay me $500, which was my deductible, to pay the insurance company. I wasn't injured, nothing happened. And so in my mind, $500 would have made me whole. So I didn't know whether to rejoice about the person going away for 10 years or not. But that is the nature of our criminal justice system. When a crime occurs today, the crime really has nothing to do with the victim. And yet we all know that when crime occurs, it's not just the one-time occurrence of the crime. We don't even stop to think about the long-term implications, like the trauma, the loss that the victim faces, and the perpetrator having been, in a way, tainted by their action and needing to be made whole. So this kind of thinking doesn't exist in our criminal justice system, and so there's no surprise that we process people through the criminal justice system and opt for incarceration as the goal of this whole thing. The interesting thing about this is once I started looking at these studies, what I realized was that this system of making communities whole again is something that had existed long ago. This is how our ancestors dealt with wrongdoing. Because when a wrong happens, when somebody is aggrieved amongst us, like in this congregation, if someone is aggrieved by another member of the congregation, what it does is it brings an injury to this whole congregation. And that injury needs to be addressed. It needs to be fixed. It needs to be healed. It needs to be given the room to heal. But normally, that's never the case. The case is actually then seen as a crime against the state. And what happened is, what brought us to this point of crime being against the state, because I could see from your reaction when I talked about the judge telling the woman this is a crime against the state, I could see some, you know, reactions around the room. But yes, that is the reality of it. Victims of crime don't have a voice, and perpetrators don't have any way, offenders don't have any way of redeeming themselves. So we put them through prison, and then when they come out, our work is done. So, exactly. So now you can laugh at that one, right? Because that was supposed to be sarcastic, right? So I often pose this question to my students in class, because these are students who are going into law enforcement or going into law or corrections or any other aspect of criminal justice. And what I pose to them is this: how many of you, if you found out there was a halfway house being built in your neighborhood, will welcome the idea? We all take up, you know, nobody wants it in their neighborhood. Nobody wants it here, right? But what does that say if our solution to crime problems is incarceration? What are we afraid of if somebody has been in prison for 30 years and they're supposed to be reformed? So what are we afraid of? So that normally gets my students who otherwise would be thinking about going after someone and punishing them to the highest maximum they can get, thinking about this. What are we paying for? Are we paying for vengeance? Or are we paying to restore communities? We pay a lot of money. The United States it's just 5% of the world's population, but has 25% of the world's prison population. What are we paying for? Annually, we pay $87 billion to deal with crime problems through incarceration. What are we paying for? Are we paying for vengeance? If that's what we are paying for, then let's say so. But what we are saying to ourselves is we are paying to solve these crime problems, and what we are doing isn't doing anything like that. Does that mean that these people who make these decisions are not well-meaning? Absolutely they are. But when we focus on addressing fear as opposed to the truth, this is what we end up doing. How am I doing on time?
You're okay.
Yeah. 5 minutes, okay, I'll make it work. So, yeah, so this brings me to some of the things that are happening in parts of the world that we can visit, we can go back to look at, and to see whether there are things we could learn from. So my work has me going to various communities. The first one is Ghana, where I come from, where I first saw the example of this. And so I go to Ghana to conduct studies to look at how we are using restorative justice or any kind of restorative processes. Here in the United States, I tend to look at Native American groups who still maintain some of these methods for addressing crime when such crime happens. And Canada, I've worked with some Native groups in Canada. I've been to Thailand to try to look at how this model might work over there. And basically, I look at communities, post-colonial communities, where some form of restorative justice existed prior to the advent of the legal system that's superimposed on it, and how people navigate these. But basically, what restorative justice offers as justice that heals can be summed up in a few, four different points here. The first thing is inclusion. Okay, the first thing is inclusion. And inclusion is inviting people in, inviting the victim in, inviting the offender in when crime happens, with the goal of actually addressing the injury that results as a result of this crime happening. So that's the goal, inviting people in and a willingness to consider alternatives that may work for different people differently. Because not all of us deal with conflict in the same way. And so we need to be able to be allowed to express ways by which we would like to participate in this process of making people whole again. So this is an invitation to both the offender and the victim. And this happens through programs like Victim Offender Reconciliation Program, which I've been part of for the last 14 years, which offer alternative approaches. Then there's what's called an encounter, right? Because guess what happens, okay? When a crime occurs, like, this is a community that lends itself to this, these examples perfectly well. So this community is intact and working, and then something happens between two people, right? So if we go with that adversarial system, what we ask is for these people who are otherwise connected through this community to now see each other as enemies, right? And so the rest of the congregation isn't going to go unscathed. You're going to be pulled one way or the other. So what happens? The whole community is torn apart by this one thing. So the process of encounter is, rather than us solving this from an adversarial point of view from the criminal justice system, why don't we come together? Because through encounter, people are able to come to the realization of what these actions really meant to both victim and offender, right? And then it also allows amends to be made. So amends, not just in the form of paying something back, although that's part of it sometimes. That's what it takes to make some people whole. But the offenders often also, after understanding their own actions and its impacts, are always at a place, or mostly at a place, where they want to give something back. So amends, in this case, making it possible for people to understand differently and begin to behave differently. And then the last step there is reintegration, which should be the ultimate goal. Because what do you think? What do you think is going to happen in the case of this husband and wife after the husband comes back 15 years later? Doesn't know the child? Who knows the connection that will remain between them as a couple? So there really is no, you know, so this person comes out of prison and becomes a stranger again, right? Not just to their own family, but to the community that they were taken out of. Because when people come out of prison, what we do for them is to guarantee that they go back to prison. Because the evidence is right there in our faces. We have 78% recidivism rate for people coming out of state prisons. When they come out of state prisons, 5 years after being followed, they are back in prison. 78%. This is at the state level. At the federal level, it's a bit lower. We are talking close to 50%. Right? But that's because federal crimes often also include white collar crime most of the time. And people like Martha Stewart going to prison are definitely not going to reoffend, right? And so that helps the numbers there. But you talk about people and disenfranchisement that happens. Where you have, when you look at minorities, especially if you're looking at black people in our population, between ages 20 and 29, one in every three belongs to the criminal justice system in one way or the other. Okay, and if you reduce that to just urban areas, we are talking about half belonging to the criminal justice system. At the same time, we are defunding schools that are the solution to some of these crime issues we face. I'm going to respect the time. And
please keep going. We can sit here all day. Do not worry about the time.
Okay, I'm almost done. So basically, when we talk about restorative justice, the goal is to shift from this solution that we automatically go to, which is incarceration, to another method that allows for healing. And this has been the tradition for in many communities for millions of years, where crime solution is not adversarial. So my work in the criminal justice system, along with the people who believe in the restorative justice approach, is to try to bring some of these methods back into the criminal justice system. The good news is it's not all so bleak. The good news is that there's reception of this, you know, because we are at a point where we are in crisis, where our prisons themselves cannot stand to deal with the overcrowding, and sometimes the disease that spreads as a result of overcrowding. We actually sometimes have to make decisions to open up some prisons and let some people out with the hope that they are not going to be dangerous to the community. So if any of us was controlling this much money and getting this kind of result, how many of us will be kept on the payroll, right? So this is something to think about, and thankfully there's some reception to it. Here in the United States, it's largely, besides Native American populations, we tend to be more willing to incorporate it in our juvenile justice system. So that's a start. At least we want to bet on young people and give them a chance. And so that's a start. But the goal is to get this to be accepted more and to go beyond this desire to revenge to a desire to heal our community.